Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economic. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry and put that pools in your money and hold that money and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75, 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And so you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. Even though you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
But you say, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again, this time on the near side, for another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No. Nope.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
If you own clothes that were made in Bangladesh, this is where they come from. It's one of the poorest countries in the world. And your clothes could have been made in a factory like Mondi Apparel. Posing as buyers, we filmed secretly inside the factory, which employs 1,400 workers.
So for just under $10.
We saw them making shirts for Wrangler and ASICS sportswear they said was for the American market.
ASICS shorts.
The managers told us the factory hasn't been approved by Walmart for production, but they still had an order for 1 million Walmart boxer shorts subcontracted to them by another factory. In Bangladesh's giant garment industry, factory fires are common and deadly. The boss at Mondi Apparel, Masadul Haq Chowdhury, showed us an evacuation map marking the location of 13 fire extinguishers. But nearly all of them were missing.
There are several hundred workers on this floor of the factory, and the manager tells us that it's more than 100,000 square feet. But so far, we've only spotted two fire extinguishers.
And if there were a fire, the workers would find this emergency exit door blocked by boxes. Chowdhury was adamant that his company doesn't allow child labour.
They're all 18, are they?
Huh? Yeah, well, until 18, we can not employ them.
They're all over 18?
They're all over 18.
Some of them, though, looked much younger. We couldn't speak with the workers freely inside the factory, so we went looking for them, after work, in this overcrowded slum. This woman and her daughter both work at Mondi Apparel. They each earn around $50 a month. They asked us to hide their faces scared they'd lose their jobs for speaking out. The daughter told us she was just 12 years old and one of many children working at the factory. She gave the factory a fake birth certificate showing her age as 18, dodging the rules on child labor because her family needed the money.
Do you think that the factory bosses suspect that your daughter is still a child?
She said they must know that her daughter is underage. The woman told us that Mondi Apparels doesn't give workers a pay slip. Last month I worked 20 days, but they only paid me for 11, she said. If I question them, they yell at me. But she feels lucky to have a job and told us there's been a big change at the factory in the last 6 months. Nowadays, she said, when we make a mistake, at least the supervisors don't beat us like they used to.
We'll come back to Holly in just a moment, but first we want to tell you about the reaction of the brands that you saw in the story. Earlier this week, we brought Holly's findings to ASICS, Wrangler, and Walmart. ASICS says that it was told by its suppliers that they don't do business with Mondi Apparels, so ASICS says it's investigating whether the clothes you saw are counterfeit. Wrangler told us that Mondi was approved for use last March by an independent labor group. But after we called the company, Wrangler sent its own inspector and has now fired the supplier. Walmart told us it will investigate, and if unauthorized production or child labor are found, Mondi will be barred permanently. Holly's back from Bangladesh. She's in our London newsroom now. Holly, for years, U.S. manufacturers have been trying to improve conditions in Bangladesh. They tell customers that they don't do business with companies that don't follow the rules. How does this still happen?
Well, Scott, sometimes American companies give their orders to a supplier, not the factory. Or they'll give an order to one factory and then it gets passed along to another factory. In that case, they don't know where their products are being made. And even if they do know which factory they're using and they inspect it, there can still be problems because the factories are cleaned up ahead of the inspection and workers are coached on what to say.
Well, this has been eye-opening, and we'll have another installment of your investigation tomorrow night on the Evening News. Holly, thank you.
Meet David Tang, a Chinese textile entrepreneur with big plans in Bangladesh. Since 1994, Mr. Tang has been traveling to the South Asian nation from his home in Jiangsu province with one thing in mind, expanding his fledgling textile business. Rising wages and ballooning costs have forced him to relocate part of his production from China to the outskirts of Dhaka. Today, he employs 140 Bangladeshi workers, making textiles for global brands like H&M, Zara, Primark, and Aldi. With the help of backers from his hometown, he is now planning to branch out into garment making by building a new factory.
China now no more the cheap price and then the due to cost is too much. So not only the worker salary matter, and then even the other cost day by day increasing. In China, our daimyo also around 150 workers. So first of all, salary is too different. For example, now in China, our worker salary average around $600, but in Bangladesh, our work only around $100.
Starting a business in a developing country like Bangladesh, plagued by corruption and serious lack of infrastructure, is no easy feat. While in Bangladesh, a Chinese businessman has had to navigate cultural and religious sensitivities, negotiate with striking workers, import all his machinery from China, and train an unskilled local workforce with the help of his Chinese employees, some of whom are now fluent in Bengali. But at the end of the day, keeping costs down has helped him scale up his fledgling textile empire. Mr. Tang's story illustrates a wider trend. Low-end manufacturing, which helped drag China out of poverty, is slowly moving out of the country and relocating to other parts of Asia.
We survey a lot of our clients every year to figure out what's going on with their wages, how companies are responding to these higher wage trends. So what we've seen in the last 5 years, every time we've done this survey, is manufacturing worker wages rising at maybe 10 to 15% on average. And we ask, what are companies doing about it? The majority of those companies say, we're moving inland. Another group of companies say, we're investing in more equipment so that people become more productive. The companies who leave, when we go and dig into our survey to see who those guys are, it's almost exclusively the manufacturers in textiles, shoes and toys, the very simple stuff. It's mostly going into Bangladesh, Vietnam, India, Indonesia, Malaysia, these places.
A recent survey by McKinsey of 29 chief purchasing officers of some of the best known European and US fashion manufacturers found that 55% expect to decrease for sourcing from China over the next 5 years. The Made in China label, long famed for its cheap price tag, is not so affordable these days. As a result, many companies are being forced to move up the value chain.
I think this whole process is part of a piece. And if you go back and look at Taiwan in the 1970s and Japan in the 1950s, you know, they were exporting, both all of these Asian countries were exporting very cheap, very simple stuff, but they were very, very good at it. And as they did so, the companies who were doing that gradually learned how those things worked. They were ambitious. They went off and started their own companies doing upstream suppliers, or they started adding some design and R&D. And so the challenge for China really is now, can they make that leap up the supply chain? Can they add value? Can they design?
While China remains the world's number one manufacturer and exporter of cheap clothing, for many, the Middle Kingdom is no longer as competitive as it once was. Ben Marino, Financial Times, Dhaka.
H&M wants to make a positive contribution to the world. As a long-term buyer in the textile industry and seller in many markets, H&M contributes to international trade. Trade is particularly important for developing countries to take part in, as the jobs, growth, and development it brings help lift people out of poverty. The textile industry is, according to the United Nations Development Programme, an industry well suited to create such progress.
Textile is one of the key economic sectors for us in Bangladesh because it brings almost 80% of our foreign currency and employs more than 4 million people. H&M has been a great partner for us in our initiative towards sustainability and growth.
The majority of the people working in the textile industry in Bangladesh today are women. UN Women states that promoting women's access to economic opportunities contributes to gender equality.
আমি যখন গ্রামের বাড়িতে আসছি তখন আমি গরিব ছিলাম এখানে হেল্পার হিসাবে ঢুকছি পরে পারমিশন পেয়ে অপারেটর হিসাবে বেতন পাচ্ছি পরে আমার আমার এই যে সুন্দর আরো আমার জীবন পাল্টে গেল আমার ছেলেকে ভালো স্কুলে পড়ালেখা করাচ্ছি আর আমার ছেলে চাই সে ডাক্তার হবে
This has an impact on overall labor productivity in the economy and on children's health and well-being within the family, and hence the well-being of the next generation. H&M doesn't own any factories, but works with independent suppliers, who all have to meet H&M's sustainability commitment and code of ethics. In 2015, we did over 3,500 audits and assessments in our suppliers' factories. All 265 manufacturing factories in Bangladesh producing for us has undergone the Accord, building and safety inspections. H&M also provide training on workers' rights to worker and management. 80% of all our suppliers' factories in Bangladesh have so far participated. Moreover, H&M helps suppliers establish democratically elected workplace committees and improve the dialogue between management and employees.
We want to contribute to improvements for the people working in the clothing industry in Bangladesh, and that's why since many years back we have invested a lot of resources to improve the Bangladeshi textile industry. And to take responsibility is a very important part in the total customer offering for us. When it comes to the workers' wages, our standpoint is clear, and that is that we support the workers' demand for higher wages. And during my visit now to Bangladesh, I met with the Prime Minister, Sheikh Hasina, and where we put forward our demand for higher minimum wages and an annual review of the minimum salary.
H&M is also working to ensure that its own purchasing practices enable suppliers to meet H&M's sustainability standards. For example, by striving to provide long-term business relation, reasonable lead times, fair pricing, timely payments, and transparent communication. H&M works for fair living wages, being paid by all suppliers across the entire textile industry. H&M is the first fashion company to have developed a global strategy for a fair living wage, being paid by all our commercial goods supplier. One important part of the strategy is implementing a fair wage method, which was first piloted in a small number of selected suppliers' factories. The result was positive, and the method is now scaled up to a bigger amount of strategic suppliers' factories in several of our sourcing market. Skills development is key for workers to increase their wages. Providing skills training is part of the work to strengthen workers and help develop the textile industry.
H&M started its training center in 1999 to train the helpers and fresh people and to make sure that they get skills and work as operators in the factory.
The way I see H&M, they're committed to continue this. H&M has been a great strategic partner supporting us in all the positive initiatives. And not only in Bangladesh, H&M also partnered with us in our work in Vietnam and Cambodia in our Better Work program.
H&M welcomes more partnerships and is hopeful that by joining forces, it can contribute to long-term positive development in the textile industry. For more information about H&M's social sustainability work in the supply chain, please visit hm.com/conscious.
And today we're doing a short one. It's Friday weekend. Baby boomers, the regularcrat generation, and I'm primarily speaking for right here in the United States. You take somebody who's in their 50s, 60s, early 70s, somewhere around there. Back when, and then let's go back in the time machine in this country, the United States. Let's go right in the middle. Let's go back 60 years. For the most part, you can start a business, or you know what? I'll really simplify this. If you had a spare room in your house or apartment or garage, there is an incalculable amount of people, normal, once again, we're going back to, let's say, the 1950s. Even 60s. There was a large amount of people that they maybe needed to make ends meet just a little bit. Not much, but just a little bit. They would rent out the spare bedroom. If we go back to a baby boomer's grandparents taking a boarder. And that one boarder, we're renting the best spare bedroom or whatever. That put not only food on the table, but paid off the house, helped pay off the house, send kids to private school, send kids to college. It was quite common. But now in 2020, in a lot of your major metropolitan areas, renting out a room, taking in a boarder, is now regulated. Not in all places, but many places. And in many cases, it's not a sustainable business model being regulated, heavily regulated, mind you, for that family that wanted to a few more dollars to make ends meet. Airbnb, their whole business model is basically based on what kind of spare space, spare bedroom, spare garage, little patch, go camping in the backyard. Their whole business model is based on spare space. And the three guys who started are billionaires in their mid-30s right now. However, in your larger cities around the globe, particularly in San Francisco where they started out at, renting out spare space in your home is so heavily regulated. Now, I don't mind a little regulation, but it's in some places it's so heavily regulated that it's either banned, the fees are ridiculous, they get to pound the flesh out of you, where it's not even financially sustainable for a person that might want to do that. So you have companies, and that's for the little guy. Now, I'm telling the little guy, and I'm one of the little people out here, you need to start looking at some of these big companies, how did they make it the way they're making it? And, like, maybe less than 10 feet from where I'm at right now, I have a little miniature house that was made in Bangladesh. And I'm going to put it this way. I got it from a big retailer. I'm not going to name the retailer. But I found out where the retailer had this little miniature house made, and it was Bangladesh. So you're going to be hearing a whole lot more about Bangladesh from me, to a point. But in a lot of these places, they're going to places where, and I don't call it slave labor. The audio I played this morning, particularly the first two, and I need to make my own audios on this, these topics, is I can't prove it right now, but with a little research, I believe that unions probably funded some of these things. They're bad-mouthing them or whatever. But in any event, if you're a little guy and if you want to make something, or if you just want to live someplace where you can live as free as possible, let's say all you want to do is rent out a spare bedroom. The first thing you need to do is look for communities. And you do have plenty of communities here in the United States where you can still rent out a spare bedroom, and it's sustainable. There might not be any permit fees, and then some places you might have to pay get a permit. And once again, I don't have anything against reasonable regulation. Okay, you want to rent out a spare bedroom in your house. Okay, the permit fee might be $100 a year. That's sustainable, in my opinion. But anyway, we'll do comparisons on that. On that note, look, everyone have a good rest of the day and great weekend.